This is the third of a three-part series, The Tale of the Unborn Victim, where we have been discussing the investigation into the 2001 murder of Crystal Taylor, who was 5 months pregnant at the time. If you haven't listened to episodes 123 and 124, parts 1 and 2 respectively, you should pause this, go and listen to those parts first, and then come back. Where we last left off, we were going through many of the things investigators were uncovering about Derek Smyer, as they were doing what they could to try and build their case against him. We left off talking about Smyer's character and his demeanor and his dealings with women, with this case, with the investigation, and how he's been able to dodge these charges for so many years. Things are beginning to stack up against Smyer, however, and the more investigators uncover about his past, the more that time passes, the more people are willing to come forward and finally speak out as to their experiences with him, the more damning this case is becoming against him. So, let's pick it up from there. The back and forth between Derek Smyer and police carried on. All the things that they knew about him, his personality, it enabled him to conduct himself with a level of confidence anytime he spoke to investigators about Crystal. He had gotten away with just about everything up to this point, so he's got to feel pretty untouchable by now. But they kept pressing on. And in looking over the case, from the most recent conversations that they had with Smyer, there had been something that he said that they almost overlooked. He mentioned that way back in 2001, on the day that Crystal was murdered, he had brought something up about that day. Remember when Detective Williams had spoken to some of Crystal's co-workers and they were the ones who informed him that she was pregnant and a guy named Derek Smyer was the father? And the detective went over to Smyer's place of work, but he was out to lunch. So he picked up a couple of Crystal's co-workers and drove over to Anderson Park to see if they could point Smyer out to him, which they did. Well, Smyer brought that incident up. He said that when he saw Detective Williams pull up to the park, that he saw a woman in the back seat, and he can tell that she was very visibly upset and distraught, which was correct. The woman in the back seat was very upset, as she had just learned of Crystal's murder. That was her friend. That woman was Jana Paletto, Crystal's good friend and co-worker. Smyer told Detective Lopez in his 2011 interview that he saw her face very clearly. That means that they were in pretty close proximity to one another. And if Smyer was close enough to get that good of a look at her face, perhaps Jana was close enough to get a good look at his face. And maybe, just maybe, the face of the person that he was talking to that day in the park. Remember, Detective Williams thought that it might have been Skylar Moore. He just wasn't able to prove it. But if Jana could pick him out as the person she saw talking to Smyer, then boom, they'll be able to solidly confirm the connection between Smyer and Moore, finally. That was something that they had not been able to do up to this point. And remember Smyer's sister's refrain. He would never, he doesn't know any gang members, he doesn't bring them around the house, he doesn't affiliate with those types of people, our family isn't like that. Sorry, but yeah, I think he does. And the police are about to prove it. Back in 2001, it never really occurred to anyone that perhaps Jana got a good look at Skylar Moore, so she was never shown a photo lineup or any kind of lineup with him included in it. But now, 10 years later, they decided to take a chance and see if she could pick him out. And she did. She was able to identify Skylar Moore as the person Smyer was talking to at the park that day. So finally, a witness who could put the two men together on the actual day of the murder, just hours afterwards. There was one last thing that the district attorney wanted before moving forward with the case against Smyer. He wanted Skylar Moore's confession on the record. They wanted him re-interviewed, but this time his Miranda rights would be given to him first. So they did. They went back to Moore. They Mirandized him. And he again gave pretty much the same story he gave when Detectives Smith and Lopez stopped in to pay him that impromptu visit at the prison in Northern California. So with Moore's story locked in, they arrested Smyer again for Crystal's murder, this time hoping that they had all that they needed to make these charges stick once and for all. And with all the pieces that they were able to get into place this time, they were pretty confident about it. So now it was time to make the case in front of a jury. And Smyer's defense would have a completely different theory as to what happened to Crystal that had nothing to do with Smyer, and we'll get to that in a moment. Justice for Crystal Taylor was moving painfully slow. 10 years had passed before Smyer was finally arrested and charged, and he would not even face trial for another 5 more years after that. And whatever all those delays and holdups were, I don't even know, and I wouldn't even want to get into it. But he would eventually go on trial in 2016. And investigators and prosecutors knew that their case was largely circumstantial and based on the testimony of shaky witnesses and witnesses now 15 years removed from the day that Crystal was killed. There was nothing that they had that juries tend to like. DNA? There was none. Blood, fiber, fingerprint evidence? None. A large sum of money being exchanged between the trigger person and the person who ordered the hit? Still none. Electronic evidence, digital footprints, cellular phone records, text messages, emails linking the suspects? Again, nothing. The singular connection between Smyer and Moore was the confession of the hitman and admitted killer, career criminal, and gang member. Would the jury believe him? Or would they believe the nice, neat, well-spoken Smyer? The prosecutor had her work cut out for her. The prosecutor argued that you've got Crystal Taylor and you have the mother of Derek Smyer's children, Tracy. Both of them were attacked while pregnant with Smyer's babies. And Tracy attacked twice, once during each pregnancy. Smyer was only 16 the first time his pregnant girlfriend was attacked by someone who slit her throat. That person failed to finish the job and she went on to have his first child. When Crystal was pregnant with his baby, he found someone he was sure would get the job done right. Gang member Skylar Moore. That time, he succeeded and for the time being, got away with it. And then he bounced back to Tracy again. They got pregnant again. And Smyer tried it yet again, failing again. And she gave birth to their second child. These attacks, they were no coincidence, the prosecutor told the jury. And therein lies the motive. This man does not want to have kids. He does not want to pay child support. He doesn't want to have anything to do with it. The jury was shown the videotape confession that Moore provided where he told all the details of how he and Smyer met and how they made the arrangements for him to kill Crystal. But when he was called to the stand to testify on behalf of the prosecution against Smyer, he recanted his entire confession on the stand, telling the jury that everything he told investigators were all lies. This played right into the hands of the defense. To them, this was just like any other false confession that we've heard in the past. It happens all the time. Okay, well, what would be Moore's motivation to lie and try to implicate Smyer in this crime? Well, the defense says it's because he was made promises that he would receive more favorable treatment in jail, possibly even moved out of state, where he could be reintegrated into the general population, since his reputation as a snitch had caused his life to be in constant danger in prison by those who would like to seek retaliation. And so, without a legitimate, believable confession from Moore, there was nothing else that linked Smyer to Crystal's murder. The defense also portrayed Smyer as a loving, doting father, showing pictures of him doing his token dad things here and there. Smyer in the hospital, smiling, holding his newborn baby. Yeah, okay. How is a guy supposed to act in a hospital in front of all the nurses and doctors and staff and family? No one ever said Smyer didn't know how to arrange all the props in his life to make himself come out of everything smelling like roses. The one thing Smyer would do anything, and I mean anything, to avoid was having the wages garnished for 18 years. That was a thing that he would kill for. And then Smyer's defense not only made the case for his innocence, but also floated the theory that Skylar Moore may be very likely innocent of this too. There was no physical evidence linking him to the crime, and perhaps Crystal's murder was never a hit to begin with. If you remember, at least one witness, the 11-year-old, said that she had heard a man and a woman arguing just before the gunshot. And this is a thing that would not be consistent with what the prosecution claimed was a hired hit. There would not have been any arguing. It would have been just a gunshot and it would have been over. And then Smyer's defense attorney had yet another theory. You see, near Crystal's body, there lay a picture of her son, Giovante. Yeah, when she was shot in the back of the head, somewhere on her or in her hand, she had a picture of her son. Now, Smyer's attorney was not allowed to directly accuse Giovante's father, but he insinuated that the picture may have been related to her killing. In other words, he did what he could to hint around that the argument that was overheard or supposedly overheard had to do with Giovante, and Crystal had this photo in her hand arguing with his father over the child support that he owed. And then this argument escalated into him lashing out by killing Crystal. But as I said earlier in the series, Giovante's dad had been cleared a long time before through a verified alibi. This is his job, right? To throw whatever out there to see what sticks, to see what leads to some reasonable doubt in some jurors' minds. The case was given to the jury, and they took 1, 2, 3 weeks to deliberate. This jury deliberated for 21 days, and it was agonizing for Crystal's family, as it was for Smyer's family as well. And when they returned to the courtroom, their faces were red, like they had been crying and fighting. So it was fierce. And they told the judge that they were hopelessly deadlocked. The judge had no choice but to declare a mistrial. Derek Smyer would be made to face trial again. The first time around, his case was severed from Skylar Moore's. But the second time around, they were going to be tried together, but with separate juries. Smyer's jury would also not see Moore's videotaped confession. And there would be some new pieces of evidence, and at least one witness that wasn't there the first time, Smyer's eldest child. Much of the following information was obtained from the official court documents. This time around, it was going to be the strategy of the prosecution to sharply focus in on Smyer's motive. They were going to portray him as a man that would do anything to avoid paying child support. They called Tracy to the stand, the mother of Smyer's two children that survived their father's attempt on their lives. Detective Beth Smith had reopened the investigation into Crystal's murder, at which point she did a records search for Smyer. That is when she obtained two police reports resulting from that search that implicated Smyer in the two attacks on Tracy, his former girlfriend. Detective Smith had interviewed Tracy in 2011, but she was unwilling to testify against Smyer. She avoided being served the subpoena to testify at the preliminary hearing. Ultimately, the prosecutor had to take Tracy into custody for a conditional examination. At the second trial in 2017, Tracy testified as to her relationship with Smyer, finally. Tracy met Smyer in high school in 1998. When she became pregnant, Smyer urged her to have an abortion because he wanted to go to college and felt the pregnancy would prevent him from achieving that goal. Smyer believed that Tracy had tricked him into impregnating her by telling him on one occasion that she did not have a condom when she in fact had one in her purse. And I just want to interject here that in this situation, Smyer could not have been quote-unquote tricked into having unprotected sex, because if he had asked her for a condom and she said no, and if he was concerned about getting her pregnant, then you don't have sex. It is not a trick. It's just common sense. Anyway, Tracy told the court that when she was 7 months pregnant, Smyer called her to arrange for him to take her to the doctor. He instructed her to meet him in the alley behind her apartment, and Tracy agreed. While she was waiting for him in the alley, a stranger approached her and asked her for the time. Then the man placed a knife to Tracy's throat and cut her. She then described that she threw him off her and stomped on him. Her finger was cut in the attack, and she suffered permanent damage. It did not seem as though this incident was a robbery because he never asked her for her purse. The baby was unharmed, and she gave birth to a daughter, Sydney, shortly thereafter. Tracy said her attacker was a tall guy with a light complexion and dyed blonde hair. Not long after the attack, she saw this man in a barbershop with Smyer and reported this to her mom and described him as having peroxide in his hair. Tracy was interviewed by the police about the attack, but no charges were ever filed. 7 to 8 years after Sydney's birth, Tracy confided in Smyer's sister, Danielle, about her suspicions that Smyer had arranged that attack on her. Tracy testified that in 2002, she became pregnant again with Smyer's child when they resumed their relationship after Crystal's murder. He repeatedly ranted at her to get an abortion, but she refused. She described an occasion when Smyer sat on her stomach trying to make the baby go away. On another occasion, he put his hand over her mouth so she would be unable to breathe to try and suffocate her and cut oxygen off to the baby. Smyer also threatened to just kill that baby right then and there. Tracy confided again in Smyer's sister that he had sat on her stomach, but Danielle did not believe her and accused Tracy of making up the whole story so that people would feel sorry for her. Always his strongest defender, that sister of his, right? And again, while Tracy was still pregnant with their second child, she was living with her grandmother. One day, Smyer called her multiple times to ask where she was. She told him that she was at her aunt's house, but she was getting ready to head back to her grandmother's house. When she arrived there, a man approached her and punched her in the face. She fell to the ground and he repeatedly stomped on her stomach and on her face. Her attacker never demanded her purse. She was injured and received treatment at the hospital, and she later gave birth to another healthy baby girl. Tracy told her aunt that she believed Smyer was responsible for this attack, and that her belief was rooted in the fact that she had been attacked during both pregnancies and had not otherwise suffered any other similar attacks during any time when she was not pregnant. And Tracy again, for a third time, confided in Smyer's sister that he arranged this attack. She did call the police, but she was reluctant to implicate Smyer. She reported to police that she believed the assailant to be a friend of Smyer's named Akil C. Akil was arrested in connection with the attack, but he was never charged. Other members of Tracy's family testified how the attacks and the relationship with Smyer changed Tracy into a shell of the person that she once was. They said he had given money sporadically over the years for the children's needs and rarely visited with them. Tracy herself was unable to keep a roof over her own head and was homeless most of the time and would leave her children with her mom or her aunt. And Tracy's aunt helped provide financial support for her children. There was a time when the children lived with Smyer for about 4 months, and most of the time he left them at home, leaving his older daughter to care for the younger one. That stay was cut short when Smyer was arrested and subsequently sent to prison for the federal bank fraud charges. That was 2004, so the older child was 6 and the younger one was 2. And the girlfriend at the time, his co-conspirator in the bank fraud scheme, this was the time that he was telling her he had only 1 kid, not 2. Then the prosecution called Sydney, Smyer's 18-year-old daughter, to testify against her father. She told the court that she did not have a good relationship with her dad. His visits were inconsistent, and he was very ill-tempered when he was with her and her sister. He wouldn't come for special occasions like for birthdays or holidays, and she always had the feeling that he hated being a father. He spent very little time with her, and when he did, to her, it was more for show, and those were her words. You remember my word, dreamers. Props. These are all props in the Derek Smyer show. She said when other people were around, he would act one way, and when they left and were no longer around, he reverted back to his usual ill-temperedness. The words that she used to describe him in court, she said her father had these kinds of monstrous ways about him. She actually called him a monster. I haven't even done that yet. The prosecution called Crystal's sister, Michelle, who testified to the court for the second time now, how she saw Skylar Moore the day before her sister was killed and that she confronted him sitting on the stairs and asked him what he was doing there. And remember 11-year-old Chavana Hall, the one who had seen Moore fleeing from the scene with the shiny object in his hand? Well, she was now 27-year-old Chavana Hall, the very same age that Crystal was the day that she was murdered. Chavana testified that all these years later, she still remembers seeing Skylar Moore fleeing the scene. That she had heard that gunshot, and Moore ran right past her. Next, the prosecution worked to make the connection between Smyer and Moore. First, Detective Williams was called to the stand. After he ascertained the name of the victim of the shooting, Crystal, he and his partner drove to her workplace. Her co-workers told the detectives that Crystal had been dating Smyer, who had also worked nearby. Smyer became an initial suspect in the killing. The detectives next drove to Smyer's workplace, but he wasn't there. Then with 2 of Crystal's co-workers, they drove over to Anderson Park, the place where Crystal and Smyer often met for lunch. They first pointed out Smyer's Mustang in the parking lot and then pointed out Smyer to the detective who was standing about 20 feet away. Detective Williams noticed that Smyer was in a conversation with a black man who he later believed to have been Skylar Moore. Smyer was detained and questioned. His home and his vehicle was searched, but revealed no evidence connecting Smyer to the shooting. However, a search of Smyer's computer revealed that he looked at a chat room regarding pregnancy, where he had written, quote, "I just got some slut pregnant. Now bitch wants my money. What should I do?" The next person called to make the connection between Smyer and Moore was Crystal's co-worker and friend, Jenna Paletto. She testified to the court that she was certain that she saw Smyer and Moore together talking at the park when she was driven over there by Detective Williams the day of the murder. Jana and another co-worker friend, Denise, met Smyer through Crystal. Jana had seen Smyer at Anderson Park about three times in 2001. In June, Crystal told her co-workers that she was pregnant with Smyer's child, and she expressed to them that she was excited to have another baby, but she also shared that she was afraid to tell Smyer. On July 23, 2001, Crystal, who was no longer involved with Smyer, asked Jana to email him and tell him about the pregnancy and to ask him if he had sickle cell anemia. Smyer called Jana, at which time she put him on speakerphone while Crystal and two other co-workers listened. Smyer expressed that he did not want Crystal to have the baby, that this happened to him in his last relationship and he did not want it to happen again. He urged Jana to do whatever she could to convince Crystal to get rid of the baby, and he said he would do whatever he could on his end. Jana told Smyer that Crystal was willing and able to care for the child and did not want money from him. Smyer asked Jana to keep him apprised of the situation. In August, Jana accompanied Crystal to an abortion clinic, but she did not have the abortion because she was too far along and she really wanted to have the baby. Smyer subsequently met with Crystal at her apartment and they discussed the baby for several hours. In early September, Crystal told her sister that Smyer did not want to have the baby and she was sad because of this. On September 11th, Crystal and her sisters drove to Texas to visit their mother who was ill. The day they arrived in Texas, Crystal's aunt overheard Crystal speaking on the phone to a man that she called Dee. Her aunt could hear the caller yelling angrily through the phone. Her aunt heard Crystal tell Dee that she was not going to get rid of the baby and that you can't threaten me and that you're not going to make me get rid of my baby. Her aunt told her to hang up the phone and Crystal did. About an hour later, Crystal's aunt overheard a second similar conversation between Crystal and Dee. Crystal's aunt heard him say, "No bitch tells me what to do." At that point, Crystal's aunt told her to hang up. Crystal began crying afterwards. The following day, Crystal's aunt took the phone away from her when she heard the same man screaming at Crystal on the phone. She told him not to speak to Crystal that way and she hung up on him. At this point, Crystal's aunt became worried about her relationship with this man, and she had hoped that Crystal and her sister would move to Texas. Smyer found out from Crystal's co-worker that she was planning to be back at work on September 24th. On the first day back at work, after her trip to Texas, she received a call from Smyer, which caused her to become upset, she cried, and she left work early for the day. The next day, Crystal was murdered. Okay, so Dreamers, I've already gone through many of the details in terms of Crystal's actual murder. But let me go back in time a little bit and tell you how Skylar Moore said how all of this came about. Moore said that he was a member of the 190 East Coast Crips in 2001, and he was actively trying to recruit Derek Smyer into the gang because he needed a person loyal to him to help him sell narcotics at Anderson Park. He said that on August 4th, 2001, he killed a rival gang member in self-defense, and this was the murder that he copped to when he was being questioned about Crystal. In September of 2001, Smyer began complaining to Moore about Crystal and the pregnancy. He said he didn't believe the baby was his and that Crystal was trying to trap a, and he used the N-word. Smyer asked Moore if she could be removed or if he could knock her down. Moore responded, "Man, it's no problem." Now, Moore wanting Smyer's loyalty is making a little more sense here, right? Moore wanted to do him this favor, and in return, he wanted Smyer to be that trusted person to sell drugs for him at the park. That was going to be the favor that he was going to get back from Smyer. Smyer then told Moore where Crystal lived and what she looked like, and he also told him that she usually left her apartment at 7 or 7:30 in the morning. In total, Moore and Smyer had two conversations where they discussed killing Crystal. Moore had gone to Crystal's apartment three times with the intent to kill her, but the circumstances were not right each time. He was familiar with the building because he had a friend that lived there. He recalled the encounter with Crystal's sister as well. On Monday, September 24th, the day Crystal was due back to work, Moore mapped out the murder. The next morning, he jogged to her building and entered through the open back door of the carport. He waited there in the shadows. He was wearing blue jeans, a dark hoodie, and gray shoes. When Crystal came down the stairs, he shot her in the back of the head, believing that this was the quickest way to kill her. He said that he knew she was pregnant, and he knew that the baby would die if she died. A few days after the murder, Moore and Smyer met up. But Smyer was not happy about the murder. Rather, he was nervous, and it seemed as though he was getting ready to report Moore to the police. Moore then became concerned even more when Smyer began avoiding him, so he decided he was going to have to kill Smyer too. He wasn't getting that loyalty that he was expecting from him, but Moore was arrested before he could carry out his plan to kill Smyer. Dreamers, in a strange way, you have this paradox when it comes to Skylar Moore, right? He's like this gang member, and he's killed people, and he's killed Crystal and her unborn baby, but he did that as a favor for his friend, and in return, he expected his friend to live up to his end of this bargain that they had, which was to give him his unconditional loyalty. Skylar Moore wanted nothing else from Smyer, but Smyer began to falter on his end of the deal. Moore had committed this terrible crime, a murder that he said he was very, very hesitant to do, but he did it for his friend, right? And his expectation was loyalty. But what Moore should have realized is that if you're making deals with a man who was willing to have a woman pregnant with his unborn child murdered, what makes him think that that same man is going to keep his promise of loyalty to him or anyone for that matter? The only person Smyer was ever willing to be loyal to was himself. That's where Skylar Moore sorely misjudged Smyer's character. Yes, this guy is a murderer, a baby killer, but he seems to still believe in living up to your word, at least when it comes to a deal between friends. That's where Smyer falls short. Even when he was arrested in 2001, Moore still did not implicate Smyer. It was years later when he finally spilled the beans. And even then, when he was face to face with Smyer in court, he recanted everything that he had said that implicated him. And by the way, with Moore's interview that was on the record, he was told at the very beginning that they were not going to make him any promises, that they couldn't. And he understood that when he made his full confession. For the second trial, Smyer took the stand to testify in his own defense. He had been portrayed up to this point as a child-hating killer. That's like one of the worst types of people ever. And Smyer was going to try and convince the court otherwise. He talked about the birth of his daughter. He was there, April 26, 1998. He was absolutely there when she came into the world. Smyer said that he was a loving, devoted father to both of his girls. He said he did everything he could to be a good father. He had, for a time, dropped out of school to work to support the baby, but went back to school after Sydney was born. He said after he and Tracy broke up, he saw his daughter at least twice a week. He voluntarily paid $30 a week in child support and purchased $40 worth of food and other necessities. He said in 2001, when his daughter was 3, he visited often, and sometimes she stayed with him on the weekends at his parents' house. He testified that his children were not a financial burden on him because his parents helped, and Tracy never asked him for any more than what he was giving her. Smyer acknowledged that he wanted Tracy to get an abortion when she was pregnant in 1998. However, he denied pressuring her to get one or arranging for an attack so that she would lose the baby. He denied arranging to pick up Tracy in the alley to take her to the doctor. He had heard about the attack from one of Tracy's neighbors, at which point he immediately drove to that alley. When he got there, Tracy was sitting next to an ambulance with her neck and hand bandaged. She did not accuse him of having someone attack her at the time. Neither did she tell him that an African-American man with blonde hair attacked her, and he did not recall being at a barbershop with someone matching that description. And Smyer followed her to the hospital and later returned to the alley to try and do his own investigation and discover what actually happened there. Because that's what he's all about, right? Solving crime and defending the honor of his woman and his unborn baby. What a joke. Anyway, Smyer testified that he met Crystal at Anderson Park in April of 2001, and they began a non-exclusive relationship that ended about 1 month later. Although he did sometimes go to Anderson Park for lunch, he denied that he ever played basketball or ever socialized with any gang members. In June or July, Crystal told him that she had missed her period. She took a pregnancy test, but it was negative. On July 23rd, he received an email from Crystal's coworker, Jonna, informing him that Crystal was pregnant. He testified that he wanted Crystal to get an abortion since they were young and no longer together. And by the way, at the time that this was happening, Derek was 21 and Crystal was 27. They had this conversation about getting an abortion at her apartment. Crystal said that she had gone to an abortion clinic but had not gone through with it. Crystal said that she could not and would not get an abortion. Smyer said that he kept in touch with Crystal to see how she was doing, including meeting her at Anderson Park at least once in August and speaking to her over the phone multiple times. He denied speaking to her while she was in Texas. He only learned that she had gone to Texas when he had called her work on September 21st and was told that she would be back on the 24th. When they spoke after she returned, she was never upset or crying. They only discussed her trip to Texas and her mother's illness. And his phone calls to her were all merely to check in on her well-being, as any concerned father-to-be would. Smyer insisted that he was a great dad with his children and had every intention of being the exact same way with the baby that he was going to have with Crystal. Now, the next part of his testimony involved him having been near Crystal's apartment the night before she was murdered. The insinuation there is that he was working with Skylar Moore to map out the plan and the murder and how this was all going to go down because Moore lived close by also. Smyer first told investigators that the night before the killing, he was miles away and nowhere near where Crystal lived. But it was later proven that was a lie, as investigators uncovered surveillance footage showing him withdrawing money from an ATM at a convenience store about 7 blocks away from Crystal's apartment. He explained that he was near her apartment the night before because his mom needed him to return a crock pot to his aunt, who lived near Crystal. While he was in the area, he withdrew that money from an ATM and went home. He denied meeting up with Skylar Moore that night, who also resided near that area. He explained away his lie about that night by saying that he could not remember exactly what he did that evening when he was interviewed on September 27, 2001 about it. As a result, he did not tell investigators about going to the ATM. He also explained that he met his friend Akil at Anderson Park the day of the murder because he had arranged for Akil to interview at his workplace that day. Smyer testified that he resumed his relationship with Tracy in December of 2001, That would be about 3 months after Crystal's death. Smyer said shortly thereafter, Tracy became pregnant again. Although he wanted her to have an abortion, he did not push the issue. He was not concerned about the burden of paying child support for a second child. He tried to be supportive and accompanied her to doctor's appointments and was there when she gave birth on September 10, 2002. He visited both of his daughters frequently and paid child support. He celebrated Christmas with them in 2010, and they attended his college graduation. Okay, let me stop here for a moment. I understand that the non-custodial parent doesn't have quite as much time with their children and don't always get to spend every important moment or life event with their kids. But come on, Smyer here got on the stand and the only two visits with his kids that he had to speak of was spending one Christmas with them 7 years earlier and them celebrating him at his graduation? Seriously? That's all he could come up with? In 18 years, that was it. I don't know about you guys, but I see dads and moms alike every day in my social media posting about the everyday little things that their children do. People post about their kids ad nauseum because that's what parents do. But this guy, in 18 years of being a deadbeat, those were the only two things that he could come up with. And remember, he had all sorts of time to plan this testimony. But anyway. On the stand, Smyer denied sitting on Tracy's stomach during her second pregnancy and threatening to kill the baby. He did say that he had to restrain her from hitting him during an argument. He denied any connection to the second attack on her on June 30th, 2002. He denied that he had any knowledge that she was going to her grandmother's house at that time. He denied knowing where her grandmother lived. He only learned of the attack the next day. He denied arranging to have Crystal and her unborn baby murdered. He denied hiring anyone to attack her. He denied hiring anyone to attack Tracy. He denied knowing Skylar Moore. He denied knowing any members of the 190 East Coast Crips. He initially denied that he was a father of Tracy's two children, but paternity tests confirmed that he actually was, and he said that he took full responsibility for them. Paternity tests on Crystal's unborn baby also confirmed that he was Smyer's unborn baby too. Smyer testified that he was never worried about any additional financial obligations that he would have to shoulder as a result of his children, Crystal's included, and he insisted he had a very good and close relationship with his daughters. Yeah, the daughters who said that he was monstrous. Right. In September of 2003, after his relationship with Tracy ended a second time, Smyer said he began dating RV, remember the woman who worked at the credit union. He admitted that he and RV committed the bank fraud in 2004 by illegally wiring $80,000 from bank customers into an account that belonged to the brother of his sister's ex-boyfriend. He said the person who received the money was robbed at a bus stop and he never received his cut of the proceeds. This was an important moment for the prosecutor in the courtroom. This line of questioning about this bank fraud conviction. As the prosecutor was attempting to portray Smyer as an unapologetic criminal, when he said the words, "I didn't get my cut," he paused and he smiled. And she said to him, "You think that's funny, don't you?" And Smyer tried to explain his demeanor as him being embarrassed that he did something like that. But she told him, "That smile says it all." Derek Smyer was cross-examined by a woman, and I bet that he was loving that, right? And she went hard on him. And I had to laugh at this one line of questioning because it's been something that I have gone back over a couple times throughout this story. She asked him why he got paternity tests done when it came to his two daughters. And he said it was because he was being responsible. He said, I got paternity tests because it was the responsible thing to do. Well, she shot back at him and said, wouldn't the responsible thing have been to put a condom on, sir? That question was objected to, so we didn't get to hear Smyer's reason for never wearing condoms. But for whatever reason, for him, the preferable options were to either rely on his partner to be on and stay on birth control, to hope that she doesn't get pregnant, and if she does, to pressure her into terminating the pregnancy, and if she doesn't want to do and try various things to cause her to miscarry the baby, and if that doesn't work, to find someone to help him cause her or the baby to die, all the way up to the solicitation of murder in order to get rid of the problem once and for all. All of these things, dreamers, were preferable to Derek Smyer as opposed to putting on a condom. The prosecutor asked him, did you tell Crystal to get an abortion? And he said, not directly. So, indirectly, you told her to get an abortion. Yes, indirectly. Excuse me, how does one indirectly ask somebody to get an abortion? I tried to like play out that conversation in my head, and I was like wondering, was Derek like, hey, Crystal, you know that pregnancy thing you got going on there? If you could take care of that, that would be great, right? But I mean, well, how do you indirectly ask somebody? Either you do it or you don't. And dreamers, I'm going to get real with you for a moment here. When I found out that I was pregnant with my daughter in the end of 1998, when I told her dad, the first words that came out of his mouth was, you can't have this baby. And I said, it's too late. We're having this baby. And it was a moment that really stood out in my mind because I knew his initial reaction to me telling him that I was pregnant was going to define him and his role in her life. And it was true. He's never been around. So I do have this really strong feeling once I hear a dad say to his intimate partner to get an abortion, that's how he feels, that's his initial reaction, and there's probably nothing in the world that's ever going to change that. Now, mind you, after the baby comes, the father may change his tone, he may fall in love, he may embrace being a father. Sometimes it takes seeing and holding and feeling your baby. But still, for me, once it's been said, he can't take it back. On the stand, when Smyer spoke of Crystal's death, he referred to it as, quote, when we lost Crystal. And you know that just really caused a great deal of pain to hear that coming from him for her entire family. And so the prosecutor called him out on that. Did you reach out to Crystal's family? No. Did you call them? No. Did you try to console them? No. Did you join them in their grief? No. Did you send flowers? No. Did you send a sympathy card? No. I was only able to see clips of the court proceedings and Smyer's testimony, and from the snippets that I was able to watch, he remained as confident and arrogant as ever. Even one time calling the prosecutor out openly in court for asking him a compound question. He was really trying to play himself up to the jury. But you know, they say testifying in your own defense is a risky move. But I don't think this man had a choice, because the narrative that was being woven about him was pretty ugly. He had to get up there and try to win the hearts and minds of the jurors, like he had so many times before with so many women that he used and manipulated. But it didn't work. It only took the jury one day to decide that Derek Smyer was guilty on all counts. They found him guilty of the second-degree murder of Crystal, the first-degree murder of her unborn baby, guilty of conspiracy, guilty of solicitation of murder with special circumstance enhancements of multiple murders, murder for financial gain, and the use of a firearm. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus 15 years, plus 2 years, plus 6 years, plus 1 year for all the various enhancements. Today, Derek Smyer is 39 years old and currently housed at Corcoran State Prison in Corcoran, California. And he will die in prison. Skylar C. Stiles Moore was also found guilty of the first-degree murder of Crystal, first-degree murder of her unborn baby, guilty on one count of conspiracy with special circumstance enhancements of multiple murders, lying in wait, and the use of a firearm. The state of California sought the death penalty against Moore. The penalty phase of his trial began on May 10, 2017, but on May 18th, the jury reported that it was hopelessly deadlocked and a mistrial was declared in the penalty phase. The decision was made to not retry the penalty phase. Moore was sentenced to 2 consecutive terms of life without parole, plus 50 years, 25 years for each firearm enhancement. Today, Skylar Moore is 38 years old and is currently housed at Ironwood State Prison in Blythe, California. And he too will die there. In her interview in the documentary on this case, Smyer's sister, Danielle, was grief-stricken. She could not believe it when she heard guilty and simply could not understand how her brother could have been convicted of this. She asked, "How could this happen?" And I know that I was a little bit hard on her throughout this case, but I love her passion and her devotion to her brother and her family. I don't have siblings, so that type of love and relationship is unfamiliar to me, and her sadness over this really hurt my heart. But I still have to disagree with nearly everything that she had to say about her brother, with the exception of one thing, and it was the mother of all understatements, that her brother is not a perfect man. No man or woman, for that matter, is perfect. But the depravity of her brother runs far deeper than falling short of being the perfect man. She just simply can't or won't see it or acknowledge it. When the verdicts were read and all the proceedings wound down, as the courtroom observers began to make their way into the hallway area, a very unique, a very real, a very human thing happened. Crystal's sister, Michelle, she sought Danielle out. I suppose Michelle very much understood what it meant to feel the kind of loss that a sister feels, because now Danielle was feeling a loss of her own. Michelle approached her, and she hugged her, and she told her she was sorry. How much of this story would have gone differently if everyone had been capable of that type of compassion and humanity? And by everyone, I really mean Derek Smyer. With someone like him, he is a person that is differently wired. A person incapable of having a moment like the one Michelle and Danielle had in that hallway. We have a word for people like him. Sociopath. Michelle said that it was the happiest day of her life. And truth be told, dreamers, having been invested in this story for the better part of the last couple weeks, it was a happy day for me when I was finally able to jot that down in my notes, that Derek Smyre was guilty of murder. There is something especially satisfying about a verdict like this. A verdict of guilt for a man who did everything that he could to keep his own hands clean. A man who was so egotistical and self-important. And not to mention a man who was such a coward that he did everything that he could to distance himself from the dirty work. A man who went around and placed blame everywhere else but with himself. To see him found guilty of murder, yet he didn't actually do the killing and he wasn't there. He didn't pull the trigger, but if not for him, Crystal would still be here. The unborn victim, Jeremiah, he would have been brought into this world. He'd be 17 years old today. He would have had a devoted mother that would have loved on him more than anything in this world. He would have more loving aunties than he could possibly stand, cousins for days, and a big brother who could have and would have been the father figure his own father was incapable of being. But Derek Smyre robbed them of that. Through everything Derek Paul Smyre put countless people through with his hateful, violent, selfish, arrogant, menacing behavior, in the end, he ultimately got what he wanted. To never have to make another child support payment ever again. And I think I speak for all of us when I say I can't describe how grateful and relieved that I feel that this man is in a place where he will never be able to destroy another innocent life, unborn or otherwise. And that will bring this episode of California Dreaming to a close. Please come over to our Facebook discussion group if you haven't done so yet and request to join. It is there we discuss the cases we cover. We share our thoughts and opinions, not only about our show, but any other podcasts that you listen to, documentaries that you've watched, books that you've read, as well as current news stories. We post about our pets. We post our funny memes. Please come over and share. You can also go to the show's Facebook page and like that page and leave a review or a recommendation. You can also follow us on Twitter at CaliforniaPod and on Instagram at CaliforniaDreamingPod. And I would also like to remind you, if you haven't done so yet, you can go over to Apple Podcasts. I know I keep calling it iTunes. I'm never going to change, but go over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review and a rating for the show. It helps give the show more visibility on the charts. I'd like to take the time to wish the following dreamers a very happy birthday. We have Stacy W. on December 24th, Vanessa H. on the 26th, Cindy K. on the 29th, Amanda T. on the 30th, Debbie B., Ann B, and Tragic Tracy over on Instagram. She's one of my favorite Instagram people on New Year's Eve, December 31st. And I would also like to congratulate my brother-in-law and sister-in-law who had their first baby yesterday on Christmas Day. We are really looking forward to meeting the newest addition to the family. California Dreaming is brought to you by the Orbital Jigsaw Network, a podcast production company on a mission to create some of the best podcasts to listen to, with an amazing roster of shows with content including true crime, history, sports, entertainment, gaming, and social media. so visit our website at www.orbitaljigsaw.com. You will find links to all of our podcasts, as well as a direct link to our merchandise store on TeePublic. Again, that's www.orbitaljigsaw.com. Thank you again so much for listening. I am your host, Roseanne. Until next time, sweet dreams.